Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Robert Clancy, who is the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Soul. Robert has put together a book on insights into service, spiritual growth, and other topics that help us understand how to get more out of life. Robert is an entrepreneur, a professional speaker, and is living in, I guess you're still living in the heart of Tech Valley in upstate New York. Is that right, Robert?
That is correct. It is a balmy 5 degrees here today.
Why? And you're still the co-founder and managing partner of Spiral Design Studio?
That is correct.
Okay. So you run a company on graphic design and web development.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us today. Can you tell the audience a little bit about your background?
Sure. I've founded Spiral Design Studio about 26 years ago. It's a marketing and design firm, and we handle everything from branding to web development and different projects, and I've kind of had always threaded in there service through our company, and I always felt like if you take from the community, you have to put something back in it. So that's always been a part and a foundation, one of our cornerstones there. And my background is actually I've been through this volunteer, journey from pretty much age 6 on up. And I think I've always known what love is, and from a very early start, and how important it is. And I've just kind of dedicated my life to volunteering throughout it in various capacities, and just how a person can make a difference. So that's kind of my other, if you have a career on one side and calling on the other, those are my two halves.
Okay, great. Well, what was guiding you to write the book?
Interesting question. I've told these stories for many years to a lot of friends, and I had a good friend of mine say, "You've had some things happen to you that I don't think other people have, or you have insights in those, and you need to write those down." So I kind of took the offbeat path to becoming an author in that sense. And I remember writing the first story on a flight back from a volunteer conference in Texas. I was on a flight back to Albany, and I started writing the story down. And I got about halfway through the first part of it, and I couldn't see the paper. I was crying as I was writing this down. My laptop battery died, so I had to physically write it. And I actually cried on the paper. And I realized how deep these stories went into me, and I never thought about them on that level. And once I started putting pen to paper, literally, it started emerging from that. So that's kind of the journey to put these various stories into print.
Yeah, a lot of them are really interesting lessons. Like the one that I think it's one of the first ones is the one on Ken that I found very very interesting. Would you like to share that with the audience?
Sure. And it's interesting that you bring that story up, because that was the first story I wrote.
Right.
And Ken and I, we were both in an organization, and I'll just give you the short story of it. I didn't like him, and I was in a higher position. I was a district director, and this guy came in. He was cocky and just, and I'm going, why do I have to oversee this chapter president? And he's just about getting awards and making himself look good. And I didn't help him, and basically let him implode on his own, and his board all quit. And I said, I can't wait to go up one side and down the other of this guy. And I started telling other people, and those ripples start going out. And, then it was like D-Day. I had to sit down with him. And everybody knew it. And I'm in this room, and I start waiting for every response that he could possibly give me. And I had a rebuttal for it, except the one thing that he did.
He kind of got you, didn't he?
Yeah, he said, "You're right. You're right.
You're right."
And I failed you. And that's when I said, I was like, no, I failed you. I failed you. And that's where there was like major, I realized I could have done better. And at that point, I had, saw him like a week later, and he had a bloody nose. And I said, you know, I get these too. Why don't you go get yourself checked out at the doctor? They can cauterize that. Mm-hmm. You know, I get them all the time as a kid. And that's when they discovered that he had cancer.
Right.
And a week later, they removed his eye. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we kind of went on this journey together at that point. And I never realized what sense of humor that he had, because I had been so overshadowed by prejudging him. So that was the lesson in the story. And he came in with this patch on his eye. We weren't expecting him. Shows up at the district meeting and says, is this the pirate convention? You know?
Right, yeah.
And just lightened the mood, because everybody was so solemn then. And in the end, I had this beautiful experience with him, because all the volunteers that were in this organization with us started saying these beautiful things about him. And it was the night before he was going back home from the hospital, where they couldn't do anything else for him. And, you know, I just wrote them all down and I read them to him. I went over to the hospital, and by this point he had huge tumors on his head.
Right.
You know, and I always thought he had a big head, and now he literally does. And I walk into the room and I read these to him, and I started crying. And I mean, really, it was hard. And I watched the sun go down while I did this. And in the middle of it, he yells out. He didn't say a word up until that point. And then he says, are you sure they're talking about me? And he starts laughing.
Yeah, right.
And I'm laughing and crying at the same time. And I learned that he did these random acts of kindness for the time that he had left after he was diagnosed. He would just help people out. And I snuck back to the hospital after he passed away, and I left a little gift on the counter for the nurse that took care of him. You know, and that, I don't know, you know, how deeply, you know, that had touched me. I hadn't realized. And it was 15 years later that I wrote a story, and then his mother found out, you know, I contacted her and said, I wrote his story in the book. And she said, you know, I've had a hole in my soul for 15 years, and your words just filled it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. We can't really know everything about someone just from the initial impression. In fact, sometimes the initial impression is totally not right. You know, it's not really what it is. Because people project different things. You know, somebody is projecting something that is defensive, or, you know, is a cover-up, and it's not really who they are.
Yeah, and you really don't know the person until you kind of pull those veils away. And so I've tried to always take a second look at things, especially when I prejudge. And sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong, and it's all part of the learning process of life and dealing with who needs to be in your life and who you need to release. And I found that, you know, you just need to release people with love and just kind of let it go on that sense. You don't have to harbor it, and the easiest way to do
beat
it
them
is
up
to
or,
do that.
You know,
yeah.
You're right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You don't always have to be right either. Sometimes, you know, sometimes people just need to understand that they're not, it's just time to, you know, time to separate. You know, just not to make a big deal about it. So that's very true. So, well, that was Ken, and the next story comes from your experience as a child, where you met the pool man.
Yeah.
Isn't that right? Yeah.
Yes. The story is titled Alex the Pool Man, and that's how I've always known him. And I was on a trip to Jamaica with my family on vacation at age six, and I didn't know how to swim, and I was afraid of the water because I had fallen in a pool earlier in my life, and I just avoided water. So he encountered me at the edge of the pool where I was just dipping my toes in the side, and he introduced himself, and he had this shirt. It was a white shirt with red letters that said Pool Man, and he actually rubbed his hand across the letters and said, I'm Alex, the Pool Man, you know. And it was almost, the way I had to look back at my age, because I felt like I was much older during that trip, and I was only six. And I felt like I always knew him, and I think he felt the same way, like we were part mm-hmm. of the same tribe or something, that, you know, there yeah. was like this kindred spirit. And he ended up saving my life three times in three different ways on that trip.
Wow.
And, you know, one is he taught me how to swim, and I had fallen in the pool during that week later, and there were no mm-hmm. lifeguards around. And in fact, there were no people around the pool, and I fell in the deep end. Mm-hmm. I slipped and tripped into the pool.
Mm-hmm.
I probably would have drowned, you know, and
right.
There's the first saving. And I was so excited to tell him, and he was elated that he took me on a trip down the beach to show me the secret area where he had shells. And he got coral and had given it to, you know, to sell for to the tourists to help support his village in the mountains. And he kept talking about his beautiful village in the mountains. And on the way, I saw a purple balloon in the water, went running to it, and ended up having the wind knocked out of me. He ended up throwing me. He hooked under my arm and tossed me up on the beach, and the balloon wrapped around his legs. Well, it turned out that yeah. it was a Portuguese man-of-war jellyfish.
Right, yeah.
And
pretty
it probably would have killed me, you know, at my size, right. The poison. And he actually got stung by it.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed me the other scars that he had, and, you know, I started learning about the village, and I begged my parents. I wanted to see this village. I had to go to the village. I wanted him to take me up there, and they worked mm-hmm. it out with the resort and had me, you know, take a trip up to the village with him. And it was the first time I saw poverty on that level, and I just, you know, said something like, "Are you poor people?" And he was smiling
yeah.
ear to ear, and he said, "Well, we are not, you know, rich in money. We have all this wealth and love and the beauty of our village."
Mm-hmm.
And they yeah. ended up parading me around the village like a prince. They put mm-hmm. me up on a donkey, and all the kids gave me fruit and everything. And I remember they didn't have any toys, and they had ripped clothes. And at
mm-hmm.
the end of this trip, I asked my mother to give all of my clothes in my suitcase to Alex
mm-hmm.
to take to those kids in the village. And that was at
mm-hmm.
age six. So that was, I think, the third way he saved my life. And, you know, that, you know, he ended up saving it in the way of providing the compassion. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's the main thing. And one thing, a life lesson that I got.
Yeah, it's clear from these stories, even at that age, you were being guided to, you know, live a life of service.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's a pretty unusual thing. When I was reading, I was thinking how unusual that your parents would allow you to do that at six.
Yeah, and they, not only to give
it really is, if you think
yeah.
about it. You know.
And in this day and age, but, you know, I talked to my parents later. I said, "So you let me go with this strange guy up to this
yeah,
village
right.
and everything." And they said, "No, we checked with the resort." And, you know,
yeah.
I can
yeah,
only tell you that if you met this guy, if you met Alex, you
mm-hmm.
knew what was in his heart, and he was
right,
such a genuine,
right.
authentic.
But it's still faith.
Person.
I mean, it's still trust and faith issues, you know.
Yes.
And you know, today we hear so much about all the negative stuff. You know, it's a lot harder to have that kind of faith and trust with entrusting
right.
a 6-year old to a pool man, you know, for a day.
Yeah.
It just is. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But I guess things were a little different back then. You know, they weren't
right.
quite so fear-based. We didn't have terrorism and, you know, the serial killers that, well, they probably did have serial killers. They just weren't as well known.
Right.
But maybe not on the islands. That's true.
Yeah.
But, so one of the stories I enjoyed was Spider-Man.
Yes. We all have that inner superhero.
Yeah, we do. So you got to play yours out for a day.
Yes, and, you know, I wasn't that big into comic books or superheroes or anything, and this happened just a few years ago. So,
yeah.
You know, here I am an adult, and my best friend, he hired a Spider-Man, person to dress up, and then the guy bailed in the last minute, and he'd been building his son up for months. Like, I need you to to come and do this, that you're the only person I know that would fit this costume, because he went and bought one, mm-hmm. and he was going to wear it.
Right.
And he said, I think it's going to fit you, and you do martial arts, so I think you can pull this off. And I was adamant, no way am I putting on, you know, jumpsuit, kind of a tight-fitting, outfit,
right.
and running around in public. And I said, no, at first, and then he kept begging me. He said, no, really, he's going to be devastated. For the last 3 months, he's been told, you know,
mm-hmm.
Spider-Man
right,
is coming to his
right.
party.
Yeah.
And so I get this whole thing, and he sent the costume over, and I made sure my wife and son were known, and I put this thing on, and I walked past a mirror, and I was like, wait a minute, I am Spider-Man.
right.
And you kind of, like, tilt your head, and you're wearing
yeah.
a superhero outfit. So
yeah.
I said, okay. I call him back, and I said, all right, what time at your house? No, it's at one of those Chuck E. Cheese kind of places. And I said, no,
oh,
no, I can't do this. And I ended up going over and scared two kids, you know, because I was waiting outside. And I don't know mm-hmm. how, you know, Superman changes in a phone booth, but trust me, changing in the back of a car. And people
it's
always
hard.
Ask, like, why didn't you wear it on the way over? You can't drive with that on. You can't even grip the steering wheel or do anything. It's dangerous. So I had to change in the car. And
right.
I was told I was going to go to the party and change in the bathroom. And he said his son would be he's too smart. He'd figure that out, that you disappeared. And
mm-hmm.
so I show up. I go in there. And the kids think I'm Spider-Man to a degree. You know, they're doing all
right.
this stuff. And I'm going through all the motions. And I did
mm-hmm.
some research on Spider-Man's, you know, foes and everything. And I'm,
yeah.
I'm doing all the speak and, the motions and the gestures that Spider-Man would do. And
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden, this one of the kids in the party, and I know him, he comes over and he looks me right in the eyes,
mm-hmm.
and he says, I know who he is. He's looking right into the mask, and he goes, I know who he is, and I'm telling everybody. I'm telling everyone in the party. And I kept going, okay, Johnny, come here. Don't tell anyone who Spider-Man is and ruin,
right.
you know, ruin my best friend's son's life forever.
Yeah.
And he gets all the kids' attention, and he turns and he says, mm-hmm. he's Peter Parker. And at that moment, I realized it's like you were just galvanized. I was like, I am Spider-Man. And so
right.
I gather them all in, and I said, do you know what the most powerful word is in the whole world? And their eyes go big. I said, it's love.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, do you know what you can do with that? I said, you've got to bring love to your parents and your brothers and sisters. And then I said, you can clean your room and take out the garbage and all the stuff, and all the parents are applauding. And, you know, I headed out, and I changed back into my street clothes. And I was
mm-hmm.
heading back into the party, and I was like, wow, that was pretty interesting, you know, being a superhero. But now I'm a regular Joe. And I walk
mm-hmm.
in the door, and all the parents come over, and they hug me. And some of them are
mm-hmm.
crying. And they said, that was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen somebody do for my child.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, you know, we're all superheroes in one way or another. You know, the cape and mask are always optional, but a kind heart is essential. And,
right.
you know, you need to exploit your unique talent for the greater good of humanity, and whatever that is. So that was one of those experiences that, you know, it was kind of silly, but you have learning
yeah.
in everything that happens to you, and that's what I gained out of that.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think people too often don't really appreciate that their particular talents are
yes.
very unique and very needed. You know, they might look at others around them and say, you know, that somebody else's job is more important, or, you know, that they're not really worth that much. But if they really think about it, that's not true. There's,
yeah.
Everybody has some area of their life that they are able to excel at.
Yes, absolutely.
So, and I volunteered many times in my life. I probably started volunteering at hospitals, you know, and that type of thing. I worked at Baltimore Shock Trauma and got hooked on trauma. You know, so when you volunteer, sometimes you get hooked into your career path, you know, as
right.
I became a surgeon. But basically, it gives you a wealth of experience, because you're often allowed to do all sorts of things as a volunteer. It's very interesting. I didn't realize how, like, they let me sew people shut.
Wow.
I was only a pre-med, but they treated me like a resident when I was there. You know, they let me do all sorts of stuff. So,
yeah,
you
know, and it's
very amazing when you volunteer how,
right,
how it can change the course of your life. And of course, like you said in your book, it really does look good on your, like, when you're in high school and even college, you know, when you volunteer, it looks very good for your next step in your schooling. You know, if
right,
you get into medical school or law school or whatever, you know, they like to see volunteerism because it.
Yeah, and it you know, I talked to a group of kids I had mentored through Hugh O'Brien Youth Leadership, and I do this mm-hmm. for the last 26 years. I've been volunteering with this organization, and it's high mm-hmm. school sophomores who come to this 3-day leadership conference, and mm-hmm. they were all, you know, saying, you know, it looks good on a resume, and my mom told me to do it, and they were kind of cynical about volunteerism, and I told them a story about something that happened to me, because I was kind of in the same mindset until mm-hmm. this profound, you know, experience happened from volunteering. And it was this man I met, and he knew my name. He was in a wheelchair, and I met mm-hmm. him by chance in an elevator, and he just said, "You're Bob." And I looked at him, and I said, "Do I know you?" And he said, "No, but I know you. You've volunteered for Muscular Dystrophy Association for the last 4 years." And mm-hmm. it took me by surprise, because I had to think, okay, yeah, it has been 4 years. I worked the phones and had, you know, done some of those
right.
things. And I just did it because it was fun. I wasn't really thinking about making a difference. And he mm-hmm. told me about a friend of his who'd passed away at 24 from muscular dystrophy. And I was probably about mm-hmm. 26 or 27 at the time. And it was written on my face, you know. And he said, "No, I'm not telling you this to make you feel bad. He would have died when he was 14.
Right.
He yeah. lived for 10 more years, and every day mm-hmm. that he lived, he thought about the people who volunteered
right.
in support of his life, and he knew all of your names, everyone that showed up at that telethon.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's when I realized I was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of experience, I held in for like 6 months. I didn't tell anyone. I remember walking mm-hmm. away from that thinking, wow, that just happened. And my soul was just opened up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget his last words to me. They were, "Without people like you around, there wouldn't be people like me around."
Right, right.
So, you know,
that's
you
true.
Realize the difference, like the difference that you've made, and you've helped those people, you know, in their lives, but you probably just did it and you were learning and sort of having fun at what you were doing, and you went
yeah.
in there.
Yeah, no,
but
I had a similar yeah. experience. I was at Starbucks, and the guy in front of me turned around, and he was a former patient probably 10 years ago. And I did a lot of hand surgery, and he had cut the tip of his finger off. And he showed me his finger, and he said, "You remember me?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, how you doing?" He said, "I want to tell you something." He said, "You know, just cutting the tip of your finger off, you don't figure that you're really going to have anything significant happen." But he says, "When I was waiting for you in your waiting room, I read a lot of the material that was on your, you know, the articles and everything that were on the mm-hmm. desk there." And he said, I'm the CEO of a pretty large company, and I decided to put some of the spiritual stuff into play. And we've been, you know, I started meditating, and I started doing a lot more with the, you know, the spiritual health of my company." And he said, "Our company's totally changed because of my time in your office." It's kind of like the guy in the elevator with you. I had no idea.
Yeah,
that and I could affect a CEO that would then take those principles into his company.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you really don't realize how much light you have and how far it travels. You know, I think of you know, a star that's out there in the universe. Eventually,
right.
that light will travel the entire length of that universe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like you being a person and the amount of people that you touch with just radiating your love, and it just continues
mm-hmm.
to grow and go as far as that will reach. It just ripples out.
And the other thing you realize as you get more and more experience at the spiritual, you know, the spiritual practices and education is that we truly are all connected. You know, it's not that we're separate. We're not separate. And at some level, we're very, very connected. That's why I woke up yesterday knowing that my partner was sick, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just woke up and knew he was sick, and he hadn't told me, you know. Nobody had told me. But we're very, very connected. And so when something happens to one of us, it ripples down. And so that connectivity just becomes more and more prominent as, you know, as you, I guess, really do more spiritual practices and more meditation and more, you know, more. And then when you see that you're very, very similar and very connected, life's a little bit easier. It doesn't, you know.
Yeah, it's almost like we're all threaded together by these little strands of, you know, the light or the love between everybody. And it's like a Christmas tree, you know. So when one light's dim, that's the when all the other lights need to go around that to sort of help that one at least still maintain some semblance of that light and what I think is love. And to me, love is such a simple, simple word. Mm-hmm. And I've thought so deeply about it. And it's sort of a label that we throw onto things or just a simple phrase. But when you really think about how we're all connected through that and what it really means, it's just, it's like the very fabric of the universe and what we're all connected to. And it's on that level. And it, to me, at least in my personal belief, every act of kindness here is like a single note in a beautiful symphony. And when it goes on to out into the universe or on the other side or heaven or whatever you want to label that, it becomes an instant symphony that plays endlessly. And all that music
and,
that you've created.
And a good reason for doing that, too, is that when you need help, I mean, every time I've ever needed help, I've gotten it. And I think it's because I help others.
Right.
I mean, and we all live this life where most of us are going to need help at some point. You know, you're not really self-sufficient throughout your whole life, certainly not when you're a baby. And then when you get older, you're going to need some help. And then when you get sick, you're going to need help. And, you know, I think I can't help but think that when people come into the world and they are in dire straits, it may be because in previous lives they didn't help others, you know, that they they don't have the grace bank account, you know, full. But anytime I've needed things, people just appear out of nowhere and just give me what I need. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's almost like you make a phone call and you put something out there. It comes right back like a boomerang almost.
Right,
so
right. But that's also because we're willing, you know, you and I both are willing to help people. You know, we don't act in a selfish manner when people need help. You know, we realize that it is part giving and taking is part of being here.
Yeah, it's the reciprocity of life, and it's sort of what people call karma. You know, like karma's
going
to come out and bite you. And, you know, if you look at it that way, and I told somebody and they started laughing. I said, I'd rather get bitten by love than stung by hatred.
Yeah, right. All right. That's true. So any other stories you'd like to share with the audience?
Yeah, there's different ones. And one that always sticks out was, you know, when you can empower someone. And there was this young woman who came to the conference, and I remember her guidance department contacting me and saying, you know, we're just making sure it's okay to send her. And I said, well, what's the issue? And they said, well, she's in a wheelchair and she can't speak. She's got, you know, her hand's not steady enough to hold a pencil, so she has to communicate through a laptop. You know, she had cerebral palsy from what I gathered. And I said, is she the leader of your school, and does she do community service? And I said, those are the prerequisites. And they said, yes. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, then you can send her. So they did. And her group, the group of kids that were with her, just really, you know, just enveloped her in that love. And I remember her saying, you know, she was typing up and they'd ask questions. And then her group would kind of relay the question that she had for her. And at the end of the conference, we're sitting there with like 150 to 200 high school sophomores and staff are all in a circle. And she raised her hand to share. And she said, I wanted to be a school teacher when I grow up. And even my mother thinks that I might not be able to do this because of my disability. And I realize that I can. And I mean, I get emotional because at that moment, we realized she was saying that with her mouth. We were so in the moment, we didn't realize that she was speaking those words. And the whole place just folded up. And that later that year, you know, I got one of those messages, like you said, they go out and they come back. It was Christmas Eve. I was getting the cards out of the mailbox. I had a bad day at work because I wanted to leave earlier and had to stay late and the whole thing. And I'm pulling all these postcards and, you know, cards out or whatever that are in the mailbox. And there's one that has a mailing label on it. And I said, I just threw that on the table. I said, who the heck is this lazy that they can't write the letter, you know, handwrite it?
Yeah.
And I opened that one last. And that one has stayed with me for my whole life since that moment. Inside, it was a message of peace. And it was a handwritten, and it was all kind of jagged letters, but it was written out. Mm-hmm. And it said, thank you. Have a peaceful new year from a future teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And it was her.
Right.
You know, and I can't even put a price on that. You know, that's priceless. Yep. And the seeing that and knowing you can empower somebody just by being there for them and providing your light. And I was volunteering. So these are things that come through from those volunteer experiences and knowing that. And that's another story that's in the book. So it's really her journey through that whole moment. And I tried to write as, you know, almost when people read the stories they've told me, they feel like they're there. And I wanted it to be visceral like that and just have that texture as best I could recall the story the way that I tell them. So people say they can hear my voice saying the story, you know, that people that know me that have read the book. So
yeah.
I'm really proud of that part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. So, anything else you'd like to share? I mean, you don't necessarily have to share a story, but anything else that comes to mind?
Yeah, it's, you know, there's so many things. I think people struggle with a lot of different issues, and one of them that recurs on my page is forgiveness. And I had somebody actually ask me once, they said, how do I forgive? And I was dumbfounded. I didn't know how to, you know, respond to that because it's just something I've always done. And I don't know, you know, there's no tool. It's like asking you, what does God look like? And you just do, you know. But I had somebody walk through, it's like you have to plant a seed, and then it's almost like a meditation that they guided through, and you plant that seed, and you bring it into you, and let it grow, and it may take its time, you know, it does take time. And letting, you know, forgiving someone isn't about condoning what they've done, it's about releasing what they've done to you so that you can move on with your life.
And if you feel so it doesn't cause illness in you.
Right. And as, you know, you're a doctor and you know, worked in the medical field, I know the attitude and your outlook play a major role in your recovery and just how you approach things. You know, if you feel you're going to go, you're going to go. If you feel like, you know, you've got time. And I saw
If you feel like you're going to have a complication, you can actually have a complication.
Yeah, yeah. And I saw my friend Ken, who was given like 6 months, and that was the max on record of somebody having this particular form of cancer at his stage living. He lived for a year and a half after that. He set the new record.
Right.
And it was his attitude. It's how he kept a smile on his face.
Right.
He went out there and still volunteered, and he still did acts of kindness for people.
Right.
And you know, even his mother didn't know about that part. And when I filled her in later, she said, you know, now I know what his life stood for. And it comes down to legacy. you know, what we leave mm-hmm. behind. There's people that have been dead for hundreds of years that are still helping someone today. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to what you leave here. What if you can right. leave a little bit better patch of kindness out there or something, you know, in your children, in family, in friends. You know, I feel that volunteers are immortal because a piece of them lives on forever in the hearts of those they've served.
Right. I wanted to mention that a frequent guest on this radio show has been Michael Rice, who got a website, whyagain.com. He wrote a book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And it's probably one of my earliest educational, he actually taught by video and then later on wrote the book. But he has a no-fault forgiveness worksheet, and he teaches the forgiveness method that Jesus taught, which is mm-hmm. ancient Aramaic. And he actually uses the ancient Aramaic language. And if you go to his website, you can watch a 20-minute video on how to use the worksheet. And I treat a lot of cancer here, and I always muscle test. You use applied kinesiology to figure out the cause of the cancer, because, as you know, it's real important to determine what causes things, because without that, you can't treat them appropriately. And
right.
a major cause of cancer is emotional. Lowering the energy in an organ through an adverse emotional reaction, often lack of forgiveness, you know, like if a husband cheats on you or a uncle sexually molests you, it can, if you're right-handed, it can lower the energy in your left breast. So we use these no-fault forgiveness worksheets for people to forgive. And what I explained to him is what you just said. It's to release an energy within yourself that's making you ill. You know?
Yeah.
It's like not forgiving is like taking a poison pill and expecting it to affect the other guy. It's just not going
right.
to happen. So, and again, what Michael says, it's not the Greek notion of pardon, which is, you know, saying that I'm going to let you off the hook for this horrible thing you did to me. It's not that. I mean, you figure that the Lords of Karma will take care of the other person. You know, you just let it go.
Right.
But it is about actively releasing an energy within yourself that is causing illness.
Yeah.
So it is very, very important to understand the mechanism of forgiveness and how it actually works.
Yeah, and that was a great, great explanation for
well,
how.
Well, that's Michael Rice. You know, I mean, I'm speaking
yeah.
for Michael Rice. It's not my idea.
I
would highly
great...
urge people to go to his website. He's translated that book into, I don't know, 12 or 15 languages.
Yeah.
And it's free. Michael is so evolved that he puts on everything that he puts out, copy freely and distribute.
Beautiful.
There's not very many people that do that.
Yeah. And there's another site, it's on Facebook, it's Project Forgive,
mm-hmm.
If you search that by Dr. Shawn DePiron, and, mm-hmm. you know, she went through a profound experience with a good friend of hers who, it was like just a one time had made a bad decision and had been drinking and got in the car, you know, and ended up killing these two children in this other
yeah.
family. And she helped bring them together in this forgiveness
mm-hmm.
because she knew that in this man that had done this, his heart was good and he was a good person
right.
who made a terrible mistake.
Yeah.
And how do you get past that? And she's, you know, after that, because that changed her, she went out and set up this mission on Project Forgive. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's like 600,000 people following the posts on Facebook that she puts out on this.
Right.
So it is a huge topic that's out there.
It is. It's very important to understand how forgiveness works and what lack of forgiveness can actually create, which is not
right.
good for anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's and I think that there are many, many diseases that forgiveness would help, including heart disease, because having a hardened heart,
yes.
especially against one of your children or someone, a loved one, does predispose you to heart disease, no question. So.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, that's an important point. I have, you know, written a lot on my page about, you know, the broken heart or letting go of grief or dealing with that. And one mm-hmm. thing is, you know, what you said with that hardened heart or a heart that just can't get out of that is, you know, letting go of grief isn't letting go of your loved one. It's creating more mm-hmm. room in your heart for the love that you have for them. And if you have right. great grief, then you have a very big heart. And you take that grief, and then if you can get to that place where you can just turn it to share the love that you had with that person that is now what you feel is lost. And I have an interesting perspective on it because I don't ever say sorry for your loss because I don't believe they are lost. Mm-hmm. I believe they're found, and they're found in your heart, and they're found everywhere around you. Just like when you take a piece of paper and burn it up, the paper's still here. It's just in a different mm-hmm. form. I'm very analytical. I'm very adept in my spiritual side, but I'm also a programmer, and I have that total analytic mm-hmm. side. And I look at, you know, the universe had every element that's ever been here, has always been here, it always will be here, always was here.
Right.
And if we're part of that, then we also must have always and will forever persist.
It's kind of like the NSA has a copy of all of our conversations in every email.
Kind of like that. You will persist forever in a file,
yeah,
at least. A piece of you is always
it
on over
mind,
there.
Actually, if you think about it. I do want to comment, too, that, you know, that if somebody is really suffering with grief, there is a scientifically proven method that's actually very, very good called induced afterlife communication. Have you ever heard of it?
No, I have not.
We actually use it here in the clinic. Dr. Greenberg does it. He didn't invent it, though. I've been doing this radio show for 20 years, so I've
wow.
interviewed a number of people, as you can imagine, every week.
Yes.
But this gentleman took the eye movements that they use for post-traumatic stress disorder. Have you ever seen, you know, where you follow the finger with your eyes?
Yes.
And then release the stress? If you take it one step further, you actually can induce an afterlife communication where the person will appear before you and speak with you. And it doesn't matter if you believe in the afterlife. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter if you're an atheist. It doesn't matter anything. It's a technology, and it works pretty much all the time. And so, a lot of grief has to do with having regrets about having not done certain things while the person was living.
Right.
So this allows you to reconcile that with that person. And they actually appear before you and speak to you, you know, in your mind's eye. And they can tell you things like where things are, you know, so you know it's them, because you can't be imagining, you know, and then they tell you where to find something that maybe you can't locate. You
right.
know that that's them. There's plenty of stories like that.
Yeah.
And so basically, once you do that, your grief goes away because you've reconciled whatever it is that is bothering you or that you needed to tell them or that you didn't tell them. And then you also realize they're really not dead. You know, they're very much still here. Like you said,
yeah,
they're in a different dimension.
Right.
I mean, you know, you have to have this technology to visualize them.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also see them in the dream state. I mean, most of us dream of our loved ones. I mean,
yeah.
And it seems very real when we're in the dream state. And I have no doubt that we're actually interacting with them in
yeah.
any of those scenarios. So, but once you realize that nobody ever really dies, it's hard to have significant grief because, you know, you're gonna be with them again. You're going to see them again. And you really don't have to waste that energy. You can, you know, you can quit feeling sorry for yourself and just, you know, get on with life. That's
yeah,
what
I truly,
I think.
I truly believe that. And I had an example where my brother and I, you know, he's a very outdoors guy, and he's always, you know, like My Side of the Mountain, the book where the kid lives in mm-hmm. the tree and has the hawk that hunts for him. That's my brother. So,
right.
And we always talked about hiking the Appalachian Trail, and
mm-hmm.
we hadn't done it up to this point. I just turned 50, and he lost his daughter. She was 18 and passed away suddenly at college. And complications for diabetes and some other illnesses that were intermingling there. And obviously, you know, just devastating. I knew he needed to be out in the woods. Mm-hmm. We needed to be out in a way and get him out of his routines. And me too. I think our whole family. And so I just called him up and said, what are you doing in August? You know, and he said, I don't know. I said, I know what you're doing. We're going on the Appalachian Trail. So we went to the White Mountains in New Hampshire. We hiked 22 miles and 5,000 feet in 2 days. When we stepped in the woods, I looked at him and I said, this is where your daughter is, and you need to find her.
Yeah.
And we hiked this whole thing, and I said, she'll leave you a sign when you're on the right path. You will know. The next, you know, after we hiked out, we hiked in together, and he waited for me. We got a little separated, and then he was waiting up the trail, and he said, we came in these woods together. We're coming out together. And later that day, we were at one of the national parks nearby. It was where Henry David Thoreau had been. And we step in the park, and I feel his hand on my shoulder, and he points, and he says, that girl over there who looks like his daughter is wearing her same backpack. And it was a unique backpack. It wasn't a standard, you know. It was like pink with swirls on it. Very, you know, eclectic. And she had it, and I just looked up at him, smiled, and said, you're on the right path.
Right.
And it's something that we're going to do, I think, this year again. We're going to go back to the trail and hike a different part of it, and it's something now that we look forward to doing. And it's just being out there. There's no phones, there's nothing. You're just in, you know, you're on your own. You're just, your 2 feet are going to get you out of there, and if you run into trouble, that's it, you know. There's just that, and it was pretty arduous to do, because when we got back, he said, do you want to know where my mental and physical limits are? And I hobbled over to him, and he said, we left them about 2 hours ago. Mine were about 4 hours ago, because you're just on a staircase for 8 hours. It's not, you know,
that's
true. pretty heavy, but, you know, you're absolutely right that, you know, they persist, and it's there. The elements are there. Somebody says, well, I can't talk to them. Sure you can. Well, I can't see them. Sure, you can. They'll leave you a sign.
And oh, my parents are a trip. When they want to get my attention, they will throw the charts off of the metal cart in surgery center. The charts will go flying across the room, and I go, "Okay, Mom, what do you want?"
Right.
You know, it's not subtle. And I ask in session, I said, do they both do that, or does one of them do it? And they said, oh, they do it together because it's a lot of fun. You know, they just want to get my attention, so they'll do something really wild.
So right,
it's really great. But you know, isn't that neat that people can do that? I mean, after they die, that's incredible. I mean, you know, and they probably have a lot of fun doing it too.
Yeah,
and you know, it's always the same. When I say, "Okay, Mom, what do you want?" She says, "Call your brother." And so I call my brother, and it's always something that is important. It's really funny. So. Yeah. No, they're not gone. They're not gone at all. And when and when things are, if I'm in danger, they let me know. They're very much still my protectors.
Right.
So
I
know they're not gone.
I always look at that I have, you know, the greatest allies around me all the time who are were there to watch over me. And I take comfort in that.
And your relatives, actually, your deceased relatives are often your greatest, well, they know you very well, first of all. I mean, your parents know you very well, and they often are assigned as your guides and guardians, because they can get your attention, and they can warn you about things, whereas, you know, you might not pay attention to other things. And so
yeah, it's always when you think you're on that one path, and then something else, it cuts across it, and you end up somewhere else, and you're going, oh, how did I end up here today, and it was the right place to be. So.
Right, true. Well, can you give your contact information?
Sure. You can visit guidetothesoul.com, and that's my main website for my book and my inspirational writings and different things. I'm also on Facebook. It's facebook.com/guidetothesoul. And then my other company is Spiral Design Studio, which is spiraldesign.com. And those are the three areas. And everything else on those sites, you'll have connections to my LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, whatever you want to connect to on there.
Oh, great. Is there anything else you want to share with the audience before we close the show?
Yeah, I just have one thing. I do have a free newsletter, and if you go to signup.guidetothesoul.com or just go to the website, mm-hmm. there's a sign-up button. And on there, you'll get free gifts. I have guided meditations. I have a book called Love's Awakening, which is an e-book of 80 beautiful mm-hmm. poems that what I call are my downloads, my inspirational. I just wake up and these things are written, and I just put them in there. And there's some great gifts if you sign up.
Yeah, and I just want to mention to the listening audience that something that we know is true because we've seen it in action is that if you're feeling depressed, down, unhappy, you know, life is not what you want it to be, one of the best ways you can break out of that is to volunteer.
Right.
It really is true. Once you quit concentrating on your own self, your own problems, your own unhappiness, and see help others who probably are in worse shape than you are, you know, usually. So,
right.
A shift occurs. And, you know, a lot of times just getting out of your own, like you said, getting your brother out of his routine, getting out of the house, interacting with other people, including other volunteers who tend to be really good people in general.
Right.
You can turn everything around. So just remember that, because it's not intuitive, I think, but I've seen it work again and again, especially when people retire. You know, people look forward to retiring forever, but then once they retire, they get bored, you know,
yeah.
and they get discontent, and often they get cancer. It's very interesting how often you get cancer when you retire. So I think there's a link there. So
yeah, there could be.
People who are retired really ought to consider volunteering. I know my mom volunteered an awful lot after she retired. And also, I mean, even when she was in her late 80s, she was volunteering. So it really does help you not concentrate on your own self too much.
Well, there's actually clinical studies that prove that when you have purpose, when you volunteer, that they find that mm-hmm. Statistically states that have a higher volunteer rate also have a longevity rate. So
right.
There's a correlation
right.
there.
Yeah. Yeah. So just remember that if you find yourself in a slump or, you know, just a discontent, unhappiness, you know, life is dull, boring, and not what you want it to be. Maybe you need to not concentrate so much on your own self.
Right.
And help some other people. So, and there's many ways to do that. You want to talk a little bit about where to go for information on volunteering?
You know, you can obviously check in your local community. There's a couple mm-hmm. great groups that I work with, the Hugh O'Brien Youth Leadership. So it's hoby.org, is hoby.org, and that mm-hmm. is in every single state. If you want energy and you want enthusiasm, volunteer with this organization. This just puts a mm-hmm. smile on everyone's face. There are people that look forward to it every year because it is just such a loving environment, and you get to work with these beautiful high school sophomores, and they are mm-hmm. just full of energy, and you know, every year they come in and have this incredible life-changing conference, and they're in every state. If you have a business background, you know, you have junior achievement, and mm-hmm. I volunteer in that as well, and I go in the classroom, and they give you all the materials. You don't have to be a business person. It's all guided, and you know, just having a person with business experience in the classroom mm-hmm. will help the community. So those are two good organizations to look into.
Right. Well, good. Yeah, and well, you know, if you have a particular thing that you're interested in, you know, if you like books, you can volunteer at the library. If you like travel, there's all sorts of things that you can volunteer at, local museums, or you know, you can volunteer wherever you have an interest.
Right.
And that then you'll learn more about it, of course, because you're actually working there and helping others, which is real important.
Right. Absolutely. And you can always bring your passion into whatever it is and then find something that will connect with that. So that's a great
right.
entryway of getting into volunteering without even feeling like it's volunteering. It's just threaded into your
right.
life.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Would you like to give your contact information one more time?
Sure. And thank you so much for having me on the show. It's truly been a pleasure and enlightening to speak with you today. So
thank you.
I really appreciate that. And my website, again, is guidetothesoul.com. It's mm-hmm. facebook.com/guidetothesoul. And then Spiral, S-P-I-R-A-L, design.com for the marketing and design firm.
Okay, great. Well, we've been interviewing Robert Clancy, his book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Soul. Great stories, great inspiration, lessons in compassion, which, of course, is always very important. And thank you very much for joining us today for Temple of Health Radio Show. We'll be back next week.